Welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Delighted to have you with us. We got a really good show today. Going to be talking with the gang from the Federal Times about buyouts, the Ryan budgets, FAA sequestration, all sorts of things. Then we'll move on and talk with Joe Bodwin and Jessica Clement of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees Association. But first, for friends from the Federal Times, you there, gang?
Yeah, sure.
We're here.
Okay. How are you doing on the baby watch, Steve?
Minute by minute.
Okay, all right. It's that close, huh?
Yeah.
Steve's about to be a new father, so congratulations in advance for that.
Thanks a lot.
Hey, a lot of stuff looking at the news. A lot of stuff going on today, and we're talking about the. I wanted to ask you, Sean. This Paul Ryan suddenly is in everybody's spotlight. He's known as a budget guy, and whether you think he's a wonk or a wizard, he is the powerhouse in the House itself, and people are looking at his budget. What's the impact of the so-called Ryan budget on the federal family?
It would be significant if it were passed under a House bill that did clear cleared the House earlier this year. Died in the Senate. It would have phased in a five-year increase in contributions to both the federal employees retirement system and the civil service retirement system of essentially 5%. That would mean for folks who were already in the system, say for FERS, that their contribution rate would have increased from 0.8% of salary to 5.8% of salary. And for new people coming into the system, it would have the 5.8% contribution rate would have taken effect immediately. For folks in the CSRS, their contribution rate would have gone up to 12%. He also would have extended a pay freeze through 2015, meaning that currently a two-year freeze would have become a five-year freeze. He's been very skeptical, along with many other Republicans, about the level of federal pay and benefits, saying essentially it's too high, it's much higher than in comparison with the private sector.
Well, it's interesting, too. He is a creature of the government. I mean, he has been in the House most of his adult life, hasn't he?
That has been noted, that he has very little private sector experience.
Okay. Steve, I know you were looking at early outs at Social Security, and how does that tie in? What are they, and how does that tie in with the backlog at the OPM?
Well, the Social Security Administration has been really hammered by budget cuts in the last couple of years. And just a little bit earlier this month, they offered early outs to 9,000 of their staff. That's 14% of their staff of 65,000. It's unclear how many they are targeting to actually leave. But it's been offered to 9,000. And so what that's likely to mean is it's certain to set back the Social Security Administration in terms of its exploding workload. Obviously, a lot of baby boomers are retiring. A lot of Americans are applying for disability insurance given the poor economy. And so, obviously, they've been seeing a huge uptick in their workload. So this is going to be a big challenge for them. They've already been closing some offices. They closed 13 offices already this year. It's likely they'll have to close some more if they lose much more staff. They've been cutting work hours for those offices, so the public has fewer hours in the day to actually go in and take care of their business. So for Social Security, that's a big setback. Now, at OPM, they're obviously struggling with the processing all the federal retirement claims that are coming in. Feds are retiring in extremely high numbers right now, but the good news is that OPM seems to be catching up on its backlog. And as we've reported quite a bit and talked about a lot in your show, OPM's really been struggling with this and essentially, forcing a lot of new federal retirees to wait, as long as 6 months, even a year or longer in a few cases, for new retirees to get their full pension. And what they've been doing is, in the meantime, paying those new retirees what they call interim pensions, which are basically estimates, fractions of an estimate of what their pension should be. In the past, that's been a real problem because new federal retirees have been getting somewhere on the order of, a half of what they ultimately get as their pension. The good news is OPM's really been catching up on that. They've been taking a number of steps and The backlog is a lot less. The processing time seems to be less. They're saying that the average interim pension for new federal retirees is 80% of what they eventually are going to get. So that's good news. But also the backlog has been steadily going down. They hired 56 new administrative specialists to come in and process those new retirement claims. And they've made a whole number of improvements, including this month sending new guidance out to agencies, telling them basically how to get those retirement case files in order so that they can be processed a lot more quickly. So what that's all meant is last month in July, every month they come out with new figures on how they're doing. And in July, their backlog was 44,000, almost 45,000 feds awaiting their full pension. That may sound like a lot, and it is, but it's down from 61,000 in January. So that's a extraordinary improvement. So good news for feds.
And the buyouts have been ticking up too, haven't they? Some agencies have been offered two or three. The Postal Service has been offering them, and now we have, with the possibility of a continuing resolution, is a chance that more agencies will be offering buyouts.
Yeah, I think there's no question we're going to see a lot more of those, particularly with a six-month CR deal that's been agreed to in concept. It still has to pass Congress, and we'll see if that happens. But, yeah, as you mentioned, Sean's been reporting about at the Postal Service a lot of buyouts there. Postmasters, one in five postmasters agreed to leave this year, so huge uptake there. But I think, you know, the good news, like I say, is that OPM seems to be getting the process in order. So even with all those buyouts, even with all the retirements, they seem to be doing better. And we will have more developments on that in our next paper. Steve Losey is going to be interviewing Ken Zawadny at OPM. He's the guy in charge of processing all those retirement claims. So we'll have some new developments soon.
And again, it fools many people, but most of this is still done by paper, and it's eyeballing pieces of paper.
So much of what the government does is still done by paper.
Yeah.
It amazes a lot of people.
Well, and, you know, you figure someone with a 30-year career, too, back when they started, it was all paper. There was no such thing as computerizing this stuff.
Exactly. And OPM's really been working hard at trying to digitize all that and scanning, all those paper files and trying to move to a paper file or to a digital system. But that's going to take some time.
Yeah, the interesting thing to me in the Postal Service is they've targeted postmasters and mail handlers, one of the crafts, but nothing about the clerks or the letter carriers yet, huh?
Well, there are apparently some informal discussions, according to the American Postal Workers Union, which represents the clerks, going on about a buyout, but that issue seems to have gotten tangled up in a dispute over whether the Postal Service is abiding by the terms of the contract that was signed last year. And although neither side is saying very much about this, it appears that the union, knowing that the Postal Service is desperate, basically, to reduce its workforce and can only do so pretty much by getting people to leave voluntarily, that the union is holding out against agreeing to a buyout offer until the Postal Service agrees to this, come to some resolution on this in this dispute over the contract terms. Just judging from the correspondence I get from postal workers, there are a lot of clerks out there who don't necessarily agree with the union's position, are eager to leave, and want to leave with a buyout.
Yeah, when you look at their website, there's a lot of dissension in the ranks, and people do want to get out.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to hear a lot about the S word lately, S for sequestration, I hasten to add. And you guys have been following this very carefully. It seems like different pressure groups, the contractors, different federal agencies are all kind of leaking or in some cases actually publishing estimates as to what damage it would do to the economy, the world, and the republic if sequestration happens. FAA had an interesting one the other day. What was that about?
Yeah, this came actually from the Aerospace Industries Association, which of course represents manufacturers, et cetera, people who have a strong interest in what the FAA does, maybe contractors to the FAA. So examining what would happen or once a couple of scenarios of what might happen under sequestration. And it would be for the FAA, which has about a 15 I think $0.9 billion budget this year would mean a cut of $1 billion or more, and the question is, you know, exactly how they would handle that. Now, the FAA, like other agencies in the federal government, isn't talking. As you'll recall, under the Sequestration Transparency Act, which the president signed last week, the administration will have to provide a report to Congress by early next month on how it would apportion those cuts under sequestration. In the meantime, though, the vacuum is being filled with studies, as you indicated, by groups like AIA. And it projects that, you know, potentially 1,500, up to close to 1,500 air traffic controllers could be laid off. More than 250 airport control towers could be closed. And the impact on that would be obviously significant. According to the study that was released this week, it could mean essentially a 5 to 10% cut in economic activity in that industry. You know, affect state, federal, and tax revenues, again, significantly. You know, the question, though, of course, is how FAA would do this. There was another report that came out, which suggested by a liberal think tank, which suggested FAA, rather than as a way of avoiding the separation costs that would go along with a reduction in force, might simply seek to furlough a large number of air traffic controllers. You know, again, though, those people would not be working, at least for some period of time, and that would affect the air transportation system.
Well, it would seem to be just sheer folly to furlough controllers. These men and women, many of them come out of the military, but the training period is several years, 3, 4, 5 years, and they go to a special academy or they go to specially picked schools. And they don't, they won't hire anybody over 31 because of their special retirement deal. So these are a valuable commodity, and the idea of laying them off is just seems to be absurd.
Well, and also, I mean, this is one area. I mean, if sequestration did come to pass, presumably the public wouldn't notice that, you know, or at least not immediately notice the impact on a lot of agencies. But certainly in the case of FAA, they would, because they're just, it's just not. I don't think it'd be possible to continue operations, even stretching people, you know, making the system, you know, pushing the system as hard as you can. You wouldn't be able to continue operations on a business as usual basis. And, you know, the AIA study suggests that, you know, there would be, you know, you'd end up with fewer flights, you know, higher prices. And those would be felt pretty quickly.
Yeah, and the ripple effect there, less cargo moved by air. What would places like FedEx and UPS do?
That's, good question. You know, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. Well, I sometimes wonder if people aren't speculating on this, and some of these are probably intentional leaks, and some of them are very carefully crafted. The Associated Press had a story earlier this week in which they said in the first paragraph they raised the specter of FBI agents, Weather Service people, air traffic controllers, VA medical personnel. They were going right across the government and saying there's going to be fewer of these and some of them are going to lose their jobs.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I think some of that's already been confirmed by the acting director of the Office of Managed Budget, Jeff Zients, who wrote an op-ed piece on this a few weeks ago, and also I think reiterated some of that in testimony earlier this month to a congressional committee. You know, the question is exactly how, you know, how deep these cuts are going to go, and this is where OMB and agencies haven't provided specifics, but certainly Mr. Zients alluded to the fact that, say, FBI agents could be, I think, furloughed. You know, some national parks could, you know, be closed or partially closed, or certainly operations affected. I mean, there would be an enormous range of effects across the spectrum, and as you know, these sequestration would begin to kick in January 2nd. That's 3 months into the fiscal year. Now, presumably agencies, or if they're on the ball, would be preparing for this and trying to hold on to as much of their budgets at the first quarter of fiscal 2013 as possible. But certainly it would mean that they'd be trying to compress essentially a year's worth of cuts into 9 months, which would accentuate the impact of those reductions.
Have we been through a sequestration before?
In a very minor way, I think back either in the 80s or 90s, you know, this idea is borrowed from the techniques that were used back in that period, again, to reduce the deficit. But the, you know, the issue now is that the deficit is much larger and the cuts would be proportionally much severer.
Thank you very much for being with us. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, we'll be talking with John Baudouin, president of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey, I'm delighted to have you with us. Going to be talking in a minute with Joe Bowden. I made him John a while ago, but I've done worse than that. I once introduced Senator David Pryor of Arkansas as Richard Pryor, the comedian, and neither were particularly amused by it. But sorry for that. But Joe is with us today, as is Jessica Clement. And Jessica, this is the first time in your new hat. You have been here before as legislative director of the Federal Managers Association, and now you're with NARF.
It is. Thank you for having me.
Okay, glad to do it. Got a lot going on. I know you have a convention coming up in Reno Sparks, but I wanted to ask you before that, Joe, a little bit about your background. How does one become president of NARF?
Well, first, Mike, you got to become a member, right?
Right.
Very simple. But, yeah, in my background, I started out as a chapter and worked up as a chapter president. Then I went into the state or federation, as we call it, federation president, worked up into the regional vice president when I was a Region 10. I had five states that were under me at that time. And from there, I became the national vice president.
I remember that, yeah. What did you do in your federal career?
Federal career, and it was interesting listening to you talk here just a few minutes ago because I was an air traffic controller. I worked for the FAA for some 27 years and then went in as a controller, supervisor, then went into accident investigation, which I did for another 20 years working with Department of Justice and the FAA.
That's absolutely fascinating. Yeah, you could write a book, I know.
It was interesting. We had a lot of interesting accidents that I worked on. I've worked on just about every major accident from 1978 to the present time. Well, I'm sorry, until 2008 when I took this job in national headquarters.
Okay, are you afraid to fly?
No, absolutely okay. Not. It's the safest mode of transportation there is.
Yeah, look at the insurance. And Jessica, feel free to chime in any time on any of this. But you've got, in the past, in the what we now would call the good old days, NARF and other organizations were trying to get things out of Congress and get things out of the administration. I mean, there was always the battle to preserve the retirement system. I guess that's your mantra, but they were trying to get things. Now it's more like a holding action, I would think, and people will be lucky to keep what they've got. What are you looking at today, and what are the threats facing federal workers and retirees?
I hate to tell your listeners that it's not looking very good,
yeah.
But I think honesty is the best policy here, and there's a lot of threats to federal workers and retirees right now. I mean, you look at what Congress has done over the last year and a half. They've had numerous votes on extending the pay freeze anywhere from 1 to 3 years. They've had several votes on increasing the amount employees pay towards their retirement. Federal employees hired after January 1st of this year will pay more into their retirement fund as a means to pay for the unemployment insurance, which passed as part of the payroll tax holiday. Federal employees and probably retirees are always the go-to when it comes to paying for unrelated pieces of legislation.
I mean, the good news, we complain about gridlock and stalemate and how the Republicans hate the Democrats and vice versa, but the good news is that that's happening, isn't it?
I think it has worked in our favor that most of the bills that have gone through the House that have targeted federal employees have not even seen the Senate floor, let alone received a vote.
What about this? The leadership, the House and Senate leadership, have agreed tentatively on a 6-month continuing resolution. So the government would continue to function after the October 1 fiscal year starts. But that's Washington talk. What does that mean?
What that means is that they have tentatively agreed to a 6-month continuing resolution funding agencies at the levels that were previously agreed to in the Budget Control Act, which passed in August of last year. So it's a decrease in funding, but not as much as, say, Chairman Paul Ryan's budget, which the House passed back in March or early April. Some people are happy about this. Some people are not. In terms of what federal employees should be looking for, is anything outside of the norm. If that piece of legislation contains anything that isn't just strictly funding the agencies, such as a pay raise, if federal employees were to receive a pay raise from Congress or extend the pay freeze, it would probably be in that piece of legislation.
The White House, which originally proposed the pay freeze, the Bowles Commission proposed a three-year pay freeze, mm-hmm. and the White House knocked it down to two. Unions weren't happy about it, but they grinned and bore it. But now the White House is proposing a 0.5% pay raise. Congress seems to have nothing on its mind. What's the status of the pay raise?
The FEPCA law, which passed in 1990, which dictated that federal employee salary should be closer to that of their private sector peers, allows the president to set pay absent of any congressional action. So the president's 0.5% pay raise could theoretically go into effect on January 1 of next year if the CR that presumably will pass in September is silent on the pay raise. You know, the CR could say many things. It could say pay freeze. It could say 0.5% or some other number pay raise. Or if it is silent, that 0.5 figure from the president could go into effect. I know I just laid out a lot of what ifs, but our group, you know, our organization and other associations are paying very, very close attention to this to see how it's all going to play out.
Yeah, because I think some people assume that once the president said it, that it was a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it is up to a point, but as you explained, the Congress could change that in a second, in a heartbeat.
If Congress wanted to freeze pay like they did 2 years ago at the president's request, legislation has to pass that specifically says pay freeze or no pay raise, et cetera. If Congress fails to act, which is what we learned 2 years ago, then the president's number goes into effect. You know, so if everything is silent, if Congress says nothing about a pay raise, then federal employees will likely see a 0.5% increase in their paychecks, you know, the first paycheck in January. The president could also change his mind and say, I want to extend the pay freeze, in which case it could be extended as well.
Yeah, so we're mm-hmm. where we've been all year.
So yeah. I guess what I'm saying is wait a little bit, and we'll have an answer for you on this, hopefully with passage of the CR before October 1.
Well, a lot of people and a lot of politicians mistakenly refer to a federal pay raise as a cost of living adjustment.
Sure.
But it is not, never has been. If they're even close, it's coincidence. Retirees, however, do get cost of living adjustments. There were 2 years there where they got none. I think the last mm-hmm. one was it 5.8%? Was that the last increase for retirees a while back?
There was one, I believe, this year. Retirees got an increase, but it was quite small.
Okay, what's it looking like? We're still in the countdown right now.
Right now, the CPI seems to go up and down depending on the month, but we are in an increase thus far for 2012. So right now, I think the CPI increase has maybe been right around 1.5%. So we're on track for retirees, which is both federal retirees as well as Social Security recipients, to receive a cost of living adjustment, but we won't know for sure for the next few months.
Right. I saw a headline in the Post today that gasoline prices are the highest they've been in years, and that always drives the CPI up eventually because
right.
everything revolves around petroleum. Phased retirement. A lot of people are excited about it.
Yeah.
I know you guys worked hard to get it because you represent active people as well as retirees, and you want to have a reason for the active people to join NARF. How does this phased retirement work?
Well, what it does is allow you, once you are retirement eligible, to work part-time and receive a partial annuity. The hours you work in part-time can be anywhere between 20 and 80% of the time you were working when you were full-time. And at least, not total, but at least 20% of that time needs to be spent mentoring, presumably your replacement. It was passed as part of a larger, very much unrelated bill. The phased retirement option does have a cost savings associated with it. So that cost savings was used to pay for highway programs as well as an extension of the student loan interest rate decrease. Right now, we are waiting on the Office of Personnel Management to put out regulations to agencies as to how this would work. When they publish the regulations, there's a comment period, folks comment, and then the final regulations are published. Once that happens, then federal employees will be able to utilize this option.
Okay, yeah, some people really think that once Congress passes it, boom, but it takes a while.
It takes a while.
You need to take a short break here. We'll be right back on 1500 AM. My Causey. Welcome back to Your Turn. I'm talking with Joe Bowden. He is president of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees, and Jessica Clement, late of the Federal Managers Association, who is now legislative director for NARF. And got some legislative questions I want to ask both of you, and some politics and strategy. But yeah, I saw your alert. Your convention is next week. I'm going to go out there, looking forward to it. And I see you're having John Berry come out, and that's very unusual to get him out on the convention circuit at all. He's the director of the Office of Personnel Management. You're going to be talking to him. What do you hope he says, and what are you going to ask him to do?
Well, first, you know, John Berry has been a real friend of NARF. We've worked with him. The OPM is one of the companies, or if you will, agencies that Federal Benefit Services works with on a daily basis. And with John Berry, as you know, we testified earlier this year on the backlog that for the claims. John, at that time, guaranteed us, as well as the Senate that he appeared before, that they would reduce it. And he has been doing that. I think that the reduction in the claims is outstanding, the way he's put on extra people, had taken and included overtime, the number of steps they have taken. A lot of the problems that they had at the time was because other agencies were giving them incomplete information, which was causing a backlog at OPM, and OPM was getting the black eye.
Right. They were getting a 16% error rate from the agencies, I believe I heard.
I expect John to be talking about that and talking about the services that they are providing and how they can improve those services over the time, as not only the claims are reduced, but we also have many other questions that our members ask OPM, when there's deaths or disabilities and all the others, and the delays in answering the phones and so forth. As I say, John has been working with us very closely, and we're very happy with progress so far.
Well, the importance of that backlog for people who have not retired yet or don't understand it is when people retire from the federal government, they put them on interim payments. Yeah. And I've talked to people whose interim payment is as low as 44% of their estimate. Mm-hmm. And imagine living on 44% of your current income and doing that for 6 months or a year or even more. We've had cases of that. It's interesting. OPM has had this backlog forever. This is nothing new. And John Berry really has stepped up to the plate, and I guess not surprisingly, he's a Fed. You know, he worked on the Hill for many years for Steny Hoyer. He worked at Interior. He worked at Treasury briefly, and then he's had what he says is the best job in America. He was director of the National Zoo. But when he came to OPM, he not only knew what it did and what federal workers did, but the importance of this process and what it means. I think that escaped a lot of other OPM directors, or they didn't care.
Yeah, no, John has done a great job. And as I say, there were a backlog. I believe at one time they almost had like 68,000 of them. And as we know, they're down to around 45,000 now. And John is looking to solve or be able to process all the claims within 60 days in the future, and in the near future, too. So that would be a great feather in his cap.
Well, earlier in the show, Steve Watkins from the Federal Times, I believe he said that they started out with a backlog of 61,000 in January. There've been a lot of early outs and early retirements, and they dropped it down to about 45,000, which is a significant change when the pipeline continues to be clogged up. Jessica, we were talking about sequestration and the continuing resolution. These are Washington buzzwords. I'm mm-hmm. embarrassed to use them, but they are rather important, or could be. Assuming sequestration doesn't happen, that is, they come up with some sort of a budget and they make these cuts that are necessary to the things the super committee said it would do, promised it would do, did not do. If they come up with those, then what happens?
Well, everyone's kind of saying right now that they don't want sequestration to happen, and each side is blaming the other as to how it passed in the first place and who's holding up any sort of compromise to get rid of it. So there's a lot of talk going on right now, but not a lot of action. In order to prevent sequestration, Congress would have to come up with a way to either push it off, you know, a certain time period, which the president has said many times he will not sign, or come up with other ways to get those cuts. And what we've seen in talking, you know, to the folks that we work with a lot is that Simpson Bowles all of a sudden seems to be back on the table. That is the fiscal commission that Obama formed the end of 2010 or 11. It's all kind of running together at this point in time that came up with massive cuts, as you mentioned. You know, they proposed a three-year pay freeze for federal employees. They made multiple changes to federal retirement system. They made multiple changes to Medicare and Social Security. And now people are going back to that and saying, well, the fiscal commission, you know, Simpson Bowles came up with this. Let's take another look at it. So I think as talk heats up about preventing sequestration, you'll see Simpson Bowles put back on the table.
That's the only consistent thing that I've heard from all sides, mm-hmm. is that the Simpson Bowles recommendations are really sort of a template for what's mm-hmm. going to happen, and that anything that happens, particularly as it relates to federal workers, mm-hmm. is likely to be something that was on the Simpson Bowles hit list. Well, and what were some of the other things? And it was a three-year pay freeze.
It was a three-year pay freeze, an increase in what they pay towards their retirement, a decrease in the size of the federal civilian workforce. And what I was told by actually one member of Congress is that, you know, if they move forward with Simpson Bowles, then we're done. Then federal employees don't need to really worry anymore. They make those cuts, it's under Simpson Bowles, and all of a sudden federal employees will be off the table. The thing about Simpson Bowles is that it has something that everybody doesn't like. You know,
yeah.
We at NARF are not going to like the changes to the way Social Security cost of living adjustments are computed, as well as all the cuts to current federal employees. Somebody else isn't going to like the Medicare changes. Somebody else isn't going to like the workforce cuts, you know. So it's going to be hard to get everyone on board, because while people like it in theory, there's going to be something that they object to and may vote against it accordingly.
Yeah, I that share the pain idea. Mm-hmm. It was sort of like the base realignment and closure, the BRAC commission,
yep.
kind of thing. Everybody takes some kind of hit. And in that case, it worked in that the Congress approved it. This one, not so sure, huh?
They didn't approve it before, so we'll see what happens this time around.
Well, I think anytime you get Social Security and Medicare in the equation, we're going to see this play out in the debate between
yep.
the Democrats and the Republicans. But anytime you get Medicare, that's dangerous territory.
And you're going to see a lot of talk about Medicare in the coming months leading up to the election, just given Chairman Paul Ryan's past budget recommendations and the changes he would have made to Medicare. This is going to be a big part of the upcoming presidential election.
You know, speaking of elections and things like that, I always like to look at the federal employee population state by state, district mm-hmm. by district. And so you're not only talking about a single Fed, but it may very well be his or her spouse is part of the federal family,
mm-hmm.
may even have adult children that have an interest in it. So we're going to take a short break here. And when we get back, I want to ask you about the political clout, if any, of federal workers. Be right back here on 1500. Welcome back to Your Turn. Mike Causey here, and we're in the home stretch talking with Joe Bowden and Jessica Clement of the National Active and Retired Federal Employees. And before the break, I'm fascinated by numbers when it gets to be election time. And if you look at states like Virginia and Maryland, obviously, huge numbers of federal workers and retirees. Also, the military people add to the federal family. States like Florida, huge numbers of both. Texas, mm-hmm. California has the most federal workers and many, many retirees. But New York, Illinois, Ohio. But they're also important in small population states. The federal population is very big in Utah.
It is
very big in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
and you brought your magazine.
I believe this is the September issue of the NARF magazine. Kind of breaks down federal employees and retirees by the numbers. And I mean, I can tell you, for me, I was surprised to learn that California has the most
yeah.
federal employees, because you think Beltway, you think
yeah.
D.C., Maryland, Virginia. Maryland actually comes in fourth, with Texas in the third spot for the number of federal employees, which is surprising and disappointing that you don't hear from members of Congress in California and Texas extolling the virtues of federal employees and the jobs they do for this country.
Well, you know, federal workers used to have some real champions in Washington State, Congressman Norm Dix, Senator Mulroney in Oklahoma, and at one point the AFGE was the largest union in Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
But these people were aware of it. They knew it. And feds had champions in New York, the New York delegation, and Texas and all over. But lately they seem to have gone to ground. If they support you, they do it very quietly.
They do it quietly. They do it with their votes, and they're not going to do it on the campaign trail because in some areas it might be a losing battle for them.
Yeah. Well, all this talk about trimming the federal workforce, feds are overpaid, all that sort of thing. Joe, I know this is an issue of yours about the fact that the federal workforce is really shrinking when you compare it to the population and what people are asked to do. What are those numbers you brought?
Actually, if you look back in my numbers, go back to 62, we had 2.48 million feds working, but the population at the time was only 186 million in the United States, which averaged out to about 13.3 feds for every 1,000 citizens. Fast forward to today, and now we have approximately the same amount of feds, little over 2.5 million, 2.65 to be exact. But the population has almost doubled. It's now 310 million. So instead of having 13 feds for every 1,000, we now have 8 feds for every 1,000. So they have to do more work in order to take and service all the citizens in the United States.
Well, and automation and computers don't take up all of that slack.
They don't. It's people working harder and longer, and it's the dedicated people that stay there, because most of these could go out in private practice and make more money. But these federal employees just stay there and work, and as I say, they are very dedicated and loyal.
I heard a friend, an accountant, a CPA, talking to another friend, and he said he has a lot of business in Alexandria. He lives in the Maryland suburbs, and he drives by the Pentagon sometimes Friday night and Saturday night, and the parking lot is full.
Mm-hmm. That is true. And you look at that, and you look at the Postal Service and where they're trying to cut their billions out of their area, and it's just... It's just not a fair system that is going on, and the federal employees and the postal workers are getting a black eye when they really shouldn't. People should be commending them for doing more work for more people.
Jessica, if they have to go to layoffs, and, you know, we talk about furloughs and that sort of thing, layoffs cost the government money, don't they?
Yes.
So do
furloughs. I mean, yeah. Any way you look at it, you let a federal employee go, and they're going to have unemployment benefits and severance packages and whatnot. You look at furloughs, so you're not paying them that day, but that's also work that's not getting done. So it's more work that needs to get done when they come back, which could lead to overtime payments as well. I mean, there's no good way to decrease the size of the federal government or lay off workers or anything. And what's frustrating is that the conversation isn't about what government services should be provided. It's too large. We need to cut it. Well, okay, if you think it's too large, where is it too large? Why is it too large? What services don't you want the government to provide? Let's have that conversation and make the size of the federal government fit what you want it to do. But no one's willing to have that conversation because that's difficult. And it's all about government is too big. We need to cut it.
Well, during the 1990s, when the Clinton administration had to face off with the Republican Congress, mm-hmm. led by Newt Gingrich, you had these shutdowns, which many of us, including me, said would not happen, and they did. And they were prolonged, and there were several of them. And there were instances of people going on to unemployment and qualifying for it and then having to pay that money back. I mean, it became a nightmare for not only the federal government, but for states and local governments.
I mean, you saw it last August, the same thing. Everyone, when I was at FMA, we got emails from members over the weekend. Can I go to work on Monday when they were working out the Budget Control Act deal? I don't know if I can go to work on Monday, and my agency isn't telling me anything. This panics federal employees, and it is not a way to run government. You know, so many people in Congress want government to run like a business, but they don't give them the tools to do so.
Yeah, I was looking at the IRS budget justification, I guess, and they claim on the low side that for every dollar they spend in enforcement and salaries, they collect $4.10. Mm-hmm. And then there was an interesting term, which I can't remember, but it was something the other effect, and the effect that if you know not paying your taxes is going to be a problem and you're going to get in trouble, it's the enforcement effect, and it then they get it up to like $9 or $16 for every one spent.
Right, and that is the very area of the IRS that the House cut when they passed the Treasury Appropriations Bill. It is so short-sighted the way Congress right now is funding these agencies. Well, we want to cut their funding. They need to run more efficiently. We're going to give them less money and tell them to still run efficiently. So they take away their funding. They're taking away funding for programs that bring back in money. It's, you know, they're almost willing these agencies to run inefficiently.
Yeah, well, it sounds like they want contractors in there. But we have to take a break. Joe, thank you for being here. Jesse, thank you for being here. I'll see you both in Reno Sparks.
Thank you for having us.
Have a good week, folks.
Thanks, Joe.